on the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Professor Sean McMeekin. His new book is To Overthrow the World, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Communism. It is 1956 in Moscow, and Nikita Khrushchev, who has emerged as the first among equals of the Politburo, Stalin is dead in March of 53. There's trouble with Beria, the secret police chief, and eventually the trouble is that he's complaining too much and he's murdered. Executed, I believe, is a polite way to put it, as a traitor. And Khrushchev becomes the center of interest outside and making a statement inside. And he makes something called the secret speech, which has, at this point, you'd have to say, was secret from no one, because everybody immediately knew about it. And it rocked the Warsaw Pact, Eastern Europe, that were all under the boot of the Soviets and had been since 1944-45 when they were overrun at the end of the war. So what we're looking at here is a temptation to break away from the absolute obedience to Moscow. It leads to disruption in Poland, in Germany, in Hungary eventually, all very badly damaged by their contradictions, yearning to be free, and then the Soviet armor shows up. But I want to go from what happens in the 1950s. I want to race ahead to first Berlin and then the confrontation between the U.S. and Russia, the Soviets, over Cuba, because that was a temptation for the first time ever of a nuclear exchange. Washington believed it was coming. Moscow believed it was coming. Sean, here's the puzzle about the Soviet Union. I can't find Marx anywhere here. This looks like straight power politics between imperial powers. Is that how to read it?
Well, if you're talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think you could definitely see an element of just raw traditional great power politics. But the impetus behind it, that is to say, why, despite supposedly unearthing the crimes under Stalin and the secret speech and thawing out at least a little bit of Soviet culture so that, for example, Solzhenitsyn's A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich is allowed to be published, there's a little bit of discussion of some of the crimes, at least those committed against the party in the Stalin years. Why then does Khrushchev carry out this act of brinkmanship? I mean, some of it was just opportunism. I think the opportunity fell into Khrushchev's lap. Initially, Castro himself was not actually really a doctrinaire communist. His brother Raul was. Castro himself was not even necessarily viewed as a client until he more or less begged to become one. And then the Soviets just took this opportunity. And they were really trying to reverse, I think, the strategic balance of the time. The U.S. had, despite what Kennedy had campaigned on in 1960, the U.S. actually had a pretty clear superiority in intercontinental ballistic missiles, and the Soviets, by stationing these shorter range missiles in Cuba, could really overturn the balance. In the end, of course, a deal is struck involving some of the missiles that the United States had in Turkey. You're right that as far as the confrontation between the U.S. and Russia, despite some of the more colorful and baroque elements, the space race, and you know even things like the Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow, and these strange arguments about you know who's going to outproduce the other in terms of meat and milk, there are elements of this that are seemingly absurd, or as you might say, simply about great power rivalry. But of course, what's driving it from the Soviet side, that is, they really are trying to prove that they have a superior system. And it's kind of amazing, but for the longest time in the 60s and 70s, a lot of American policymakers, particularly in Langley, Virginia, and the CIA actually believed them. They really thought the Soviets were going to surpass the West, that there was this superior variety of economic planning that in the end would produce greater economic growth and perhaps a greater bounty and at the very least a superior nuclear arsenal. And the Soviets actually do pretty well in the realm of weapons and in the arms race. The Soviets actually do achieve an edge by the mid 1970s. It's kind of thin. It's not drastically superior. But you know, in the end, I suppose the line that people said in retrospect, the Soviets were upper volta with rockets, that their economy was in the end inferior. But that's not what people thought back in the 60s and 70s. If you actually revisit that, really right into the 1980s, I think most of the policymakers in Washington thought that the United States was losing the Cold War.
Yes, we come to this magic moment. Somewhere between 1970 and 1980, there was a perception that the Soviet Union was normal, that Leninist Marxism was just a competing brand of ideology to be acknowledged, and not to look very hard at the mass murder that it had built its reputation upon. And this is the time of so-called détente between the nuclear power of the United States and the nuclear power of the Soviet Union. That conversation begins out of Vietnam, but it's the effort of the American counselors to separate China and Russia and to go to China, as Mr. Nixon does in 1972, and to make inroads into the war between Moscow and Washington. One of those inroads was in space, as the professor mentions, the Apollo Soyuz mission of 1975. That's detente. The Soviets are doing very well, and we come to an ironic moment that you feature in your reporting, Sean, that I love, how in 1979, the Politburo all agreed with Andropov at the table, I believe Brezhnev might have been there as well, we should not do anything violent about Afghanistan. And then what, 8 months later, they do something violent about Afghanistan? How do we remember that now? What made them throw away all the achievements they'd put together for the last 10 years for Afghanistan?
It is rather remarkable to see the Soviets making such a similar mistake to the one the United States had arguably made in getting sucked into Vietnam and Indochina, that at least Andropov, head of the KGB, and some of the other members of the Politburo, I think, saw quite clearly the dangers. And they realized they were kind of wizened old cynics, and they realized that there was no real demand for Marxist communism in Afghanistan, that outside the main towns, the people were still quite tribal, and obviously Islam still had purchase to the extent that tribalism didn't. I think they understood that perfectly well, but in the end it turned into one of those pride things where, you know, their client was killed and so they had to seek vengeance. And so they did. They got sucked and they got drawn in, and it turned out to be this tremendous opportunity for the United States to turn the tables. So, you know, you're talking about hard power. Obviously, a lot of this was hard power. The United States getting arms to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, Reagan ramping up the conventional arms buildup in the 1980s, leaning on Saudi Arabia to basically unleash this kind of spare production capacity and flood the market so that the oil price, which the Soviets were increasingly dependent on for a lot of their hard currency income, you know, all of these kind of hard power elements put huge pressure on the Soviet Union. They're very different from détente and Ostpolitik, which had all been the other direction, all ways of kind of easing up on the Soviets and allowing them access to Western loans and easing up the pressure and really allowing the Soviets, frankly, to kind of surpass the U.S. and its allies for a while in the 1970s in the arms race. The 1980s was one of confrontation. Now, I don't think it necessarily had to lead to the fall of the Soviet Union. I think it did lead, of course, Gorbachev to try to reinvigorate Soviet communism. We forget this. We think about Gorbachev kind of in retrospect as something of a pacifist or a peacemaker who wanted to surrender the Cold War, at the very least was willing to dial down the competition. But of course, that's not what he was trying to do when he came to power in 1985. He's launching a new five-year plan, which is all about ramping up military production targets, you know, and everything from ICBMs to tanks, nuclear submarines, even biological weapons. The Soviets were actually ramping up expenditure on arms in the 1980s. Just in the end, this expenditure bankrupted the Soviet Union. And so in the end, I think it was predominantly an economic failure. There are definitely some strategic and political elements involved in Gorbachev, I think, misreading the political and international situation. But it was absolutely this kind of budgetary pressure placed on the Soviets by the Cold War and the arms race. And Gorbachev's effort to reinvigorate Soviet communism is, I think, in the end, what killed the sick patient.
I'm glad you bring up Mikhail Gorbachev, because he emphasized when he joined the Politburo and his biography validates the fact that he was a very close reader of Lenin and Marx. Nobody reads them, but he did, and he studied mm-hmm. them. And his idea was to turn the Soviets away from their big power conduct and back to the original vision that he believed was in Marx and Lenin. Did anybody listen to him?
Well, Gorbachev certainly thought that communism could work. He wanted to clean it up a bit. He wanted to have higher production standards and qualities. So there was even a kind of almost quasi-prohibition. He wanted people to drink less. He wanted to get rid of the corruption, which, you know, frankly, was part of what allowed the system to work at all. I think that's the part he really didn't understand. He actually wanted them to plan better and to have more intelligent state bureaucracy and more intelligent planning. And there were even going to be more planning ministries. It's just they were going to do a better job of it, and they would have quality control and certain collectives which would be a little bit more ground up and certain accountability of the managers. He was absolutely trying to reinvigorate communism. In that sense, he was arguably the last true believing communist in the Soviet Union, or at least one of the last of them. I think what he didn't understand was that without the corruption, really, I think the economy really wouldn't have been working at all. He understood that there were problems. He just didn't really understand how to fix them. He was kind of a Don Quixote tilting at windmills when it came to economic reform. And he also misunderstood, and this is where I think Deng Xiaoping was just a better politician, or you might say a more effective statesman, was that in the end, the system really did require force to keep it together. In the end, you absolutely had to have the security organs with a firm control of course, capital cities and critical choke points of the country as a whole. I think in the end, Gorbachev really didn't understand that the regime he was running was not really popular. In the end, it rested on force.
I'm speaking with Professor Sean McMeekin to Overthrow the World, the Rise and Fall and Rise of Communism. Remember that formula. Marxist-Leninists, whether they've read the books or not, depend upon extreme violence to come into power and depend upon violence to stay in power. And when we come back, the fall of the Soviets and the rise of communism again.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.